Okay, it is now 9 o'clock, so we have a lot I want to do, but I received many, you're welcome, I received many emails, so let me just briefly respond to them, and then we'll move on. Who's the publisher? I don't know. I think the publisher is Aronson, who's out of business, but you'll find it on Amazon or AB Books or something. Okay, let me first take a second, because I see there's still some people who aren't clear on this, the business we spoke about driving. So just briefly let me say, driving a car on Shabbos is a Torah prohibition, no question about it. Being driven somewhere is a rabbinic prohibition. So, and you're not allowed to do a rabbinic prohibition. However, there are times when you can do a rabbinic prohibition if it's necessary. And certainly, if you ask a rabbi, my relative is going to violate a Torah prohibition or a rabbinic prohibition, the rabbi would say better to do the rabbinic prohibition. But that doesn't mean that the shul is permitted to hire the driver to prevent the rabbinic prohibition, although I did mention that apparently some posek has given his approval for the situation in the Hamptons. Getting on a bus or something like that, that's really technically not any prohibition, although there's other issues involved, Shabbos spirit, Marasayan, etc. That's why those are the issues that become a real machlokas, and why Rav Uziel and others were willing to permit it until they saw what it led to. I just got a book sent to me. I'll see it tomorrow at Scranton, by Tshuvot by Rav Pinchas Goldschmidt. He is the chief rabbi of Moscow, or I guess, as David Berger says, he is the non-Chabad chief rabbi of Moscow. He's been battling the Chabad next. And I saw from the table of contents, which someone faxed me, that he had a tshuva on this very question that we said the Rav answered, can these sort of Balei tshuva types go on the subway to get the shul? So I'll see and I'll report next week what he says. I'm certain he says no. These are not the sort of things that can be permitted today. Also, people asked me to clarify a few more things about the situation of the rabbinate in Israel. There was material in the news today and yesterday in the Israeli papers, so let me spend two more minutes on this, especially because it makes a good comparison with the people we're dealing with. We're dealing with Gadol Yisrael, the leaders of religious Zionism. Here I have a nice picture of Rav Unterman. Those who don't know, if you want to make meme the whole screen, you can do that by the lower right-hand corner, or you can see a no image available if that's what you want. This thing, I'll just call your attention to, these big yarmulkes that go high up, Rav Moshe used to wear, David Lifshitz. I don't know if you can get them anywhere. I've been trying to get one for a while. I don't know, maybe I could wear it on Purim or something, but these were common yarmulkes in Lithuania, where it sticks up, I don't know, like a koppel they called it or something. Here's the three problems. The way I see it, the religious Zionists, first you have to understand, in Israel, it's not like in America. In Israel, the religious Zionist community is totally separate from the Haredim. They have their own rabbis, their own poskim, their teachers are separate. When a Haredi Rav gives a psak, it has no effect on their life. In America and Canada, we're very different here. We have Haredim and the modern Orthodox merge together. The Haredi rabbis are rabbis in modern Orthodox shuls. Haredi rabbis often speak at modern Orthodox shuls. They give shiurim there. Of course, it's never the other way. Modern Orthodox rabbis are never welcome to speak in the Haredi shuls, but that's the reality. They teach in the schools. The OU was full of Haredim. Rebelsky is together with Rav Schechter, one of the poskim. The RCA has Rav David Cohen. So it's a very different situation. But the three problems that the religious Zionists have, which really began with the last election, let me first look at this. Okay, yeah, I don't know if you were here, Simcha, when we discussed all about this in the last two classes, the notion of when that you can certainly have a non-Jew drive you sometimes, and we got into that whole discussion. The first issue... Well, the overriding issue is the issue of Zionism. The religious Zionist community and the modern Orthodox community feels let down because how can you have Dayanim judges if they don't share the ethos of the state? I could speak in America now. If you thought the Supreme Court justices were to come and decide that Plessy versus Ferguson was the law of the land and Brown versus Board of Education was decided improperly, there would be a real disconnect. So the situation in Israel is you have all these Dayanim and big rabbis who don't have any connection to the state, don't feel any civil responsibilities, don't go to the army, so it's very different. And this is manifest in three ways. First, it's a Shemitah issue, where they refuse to give permission to sell the land when everyone knows that today it needs to be done economically on a large scale. Israel's economy will be destroyed if this is not done for the farms. If individuals want to be machmir, that's always been fine, although Professor Sperber, when he was in Toronto a couple of weeks ago, said that although his whole life he has always been machmir and not to rely on the Heter Mechira, now we have a different problem, because if you don't rely on Heter Mechira, you're actually eating produce that comes from Gaza. In fact, with all the rockets falling, they still permit vegetables to be brought across the border, and you're literally giving money to people to buy rockets. And if you've been reading the last week, you see what's been happening. People were killed, and people have been injured terribly, young children. So that's the one issue. The other issue is conversion, and we'll get back to it in a few minutes with Rav Unterman, because the Russian emigration began in Rav Unterman's tenure as a chief rabbi, and he had to deal with it, and now it's the same issue multiplied. There are over 300,000 non-Jewish Russians in the state of Israel. They are Israeli. They go to the army. They speak Hebrew. And this is leading to intermarriage left and right, and they can't be married in Israel. They're going to Cyprus or elsewhere in Europe. It's untenable to have a situation where you have a Jewish state and you have hundreds of thousands of non-Jewish Israelis. That was never the case. You had Arabs, and no one confused Arabs, and then you had Israelis. And now you have non-Jews Israelis. So for the religious Zionists and the non-Orthodox, since this is an untenable situation, there has to be leniencies brought to bear in terms of conversion. Following the approach of Rav Yossi Hoffman, Rav Uziel, we'll see today Rav Unterman and Rav Gorin. The Haredim, this is not a concern for them because they don't have a Klal Yisrael or an Eretz Yisrael perspective. This doesn't affect their community. They don't intermarry with these people, and it's not an issue for them. So you have this is the second big issue that the religious Zionists feel let down, and this is what's leading them to disengage from the official rabbinate. And the third one is the position of women. The position of women in Israel in the Bat Pei Din is really terrible. If anyone saw the reports of Rabbi Teitz's lecture in Highland Park on Saturday night, he really said it like it is, that you have many Bat Pei Din, and where the rabbis just have no sympathy for the situation of the women. As he put it, they don't even recognize a female gender. And he said you should not confuse the length of a beard with either piety or understanding in these matters. And women, especially in Israel, you are in a very bad situation there, because it's almost impossible to get the rabbinate to order a get. And you have women who've been living apart from husbands for years, and the rabbinate simply says, make shalom bayis. So it's a terrible situation there for the women. Now, this came to the fore in just today's Ma'ariv, the Yahadut section, Ynet. You have an article here in which Shas is criticizing the religious Zionists, because the religious Zionists are fighting against and refusing to allow extended powers to the Bat Pei Din. And the religious Zionist replied, and here's a quote, and this should people who are in the class with Rav Herzog, you'd appreciate this. The response from one of the modern Orthodox organizations is, exactly, we are preventing this, and we're going to be in opposition to the Dayanim. The modern Orthodox organizations are fighting the Dayanim, fighting the power of the Bat Pei Din, because, as it says here, in Bat Pei HaDin Hayu Kamo, the Chazon Osho Rav Herzog, if the Bat Pei Din today, they said, were run like Rav Herzog ran it, and the Dayanim had an appreciation for the way the people lived and had sympathy for the women, then they wouldn't oppose it. But the modern Orthodox, the religious Zionists in Israel right now, see the Bat Pei Din as Haredi, and that's not a problem in a place like America, but in Israel, when that's the only base din, they see the Bat Pei Din as in opposition to them, as taking over, as trying to destroy their way of life. So a huge effort has been mounted by the modern Orthodox to basically put a stop to the Bat Pei Din. And there's one modern Orthodox woman, one of the leaders of Koleach, who's even called for people to do non-halachic marriages, either pilagshim or just get married with Adin, not through the Beis Din, because once you get married in the Beis Din, then you're stuck with them. So it's a real problem, and we don't know where it's going to lead. The other issue someone asked me about, and I'll conclude with this before we move on, was the Rav Metzger situation, and there was two more things relevant to that. Here you have yesterday's paper, where it says, Rav Metzger Nishar, since his election, a few years ago, many people have been trying to get rid of him. The religious Zionists have been trying to get rid of him, and the Attorney General. And I mentioned that he was elected. He wasn't qualified to be the Av Beit Din. Well, it turns out that the Dayanim ruled that he now could be on the Beit Din. So that supposedly would settle matters, but the religious Zionists are refusing to accept it, and they're going to go to the high court because they think that these Dayanim should have refused himself. So you have a real battle there. It's interesting because today will be Sigvard Wunderman, who was the leader of the religious Zionists, and he was the symbol of religious Zionism. And today the religious Zionists and the modern Orthodox have disengaged, and they see it as an institution in opposition. And it's just funny, I got yesterday, here's a Haredi scandal sheet, but it's a Hasidisha one. So you have here, it's called the Haredisha Welt. But you have here, Shanda. It says, Metzger bleibt Rav Rashi. And Metzger remains chief rabbi, and he's going to lead the Beit Din. And if you open it up, you have, Yona Metzger, Welt Shanda, they call it a world Shanda, and at the end they say, the gross Shanda is fun her of Yosef Shalom Yoshev. Must have kafir to them itself. They're saying the worst, you see the Hasidim, they're saying the problem is that, Rav Yoshev has created this because he put in a figure who's not qualified. So you see, it's a real problem. I think that answers the questions you had. I'll just raise one more thing because I think some of you might find interesting. A theme of many of these lectures is really the decline of the modern Orthodox from their heyday in the 50s and 60s. When I say heyday, I don't mean heyday in terms of religious observance. There's much more religious observance today among the modern Orthodox than there was in the 50s. But you had Gedolim in the 1950s and 60s, who were, even into the 70s, who were really identified with modern Orthodoxy. You don't have that today. And one of the trends we've seen, of course, is the movement to Glock Kosher. So I found it interesting that the modern Orthodox are actually fighting back. An email was sent out that the three modern Orthodox rabbis of Los Angeles, Weil, Muskin, and Konevsky, have now given approval for next week non-glot meat to be sold. This hasn't been done in probably 20 years, where a rabbinate permits non-glot meat. Now, this is Rubashkin meat. Rubashkin meat. It comes, we have some from St. Paul. The Rubashkin meat, you can tell me if I'm wrong on this, all the meat from Rubashkin that's not glot kosher, that is, they check it and it's not glot, it's repackaged because the OU will no longer sell non-glot meat. It's not real glot anyway, but they won't sell non-glot, and it's resold under the shlacha of Rabbi Zellengold, I think his name is. If I'm not mistaken, he's a Chabadnik from Minnesota. It's 100% reliable. And it's under OU Mashkichim and OU Shlita. This meat is now going to be sold in Los Angeles, and it's the first attempt by the modern Orthodox to finally go up against the glot kosher, because most people have assumed that glot kosher is the only kosher. So I think that's interesting. We'll see whether this takes on anywhere else. I don't know. Let us move on then. Are we really better off today? I guess we're better in some areas and worse in another. We ended last class talking with Rav Unterman. I want to continue with the biography for a few minutes and then look at some of his significant rulings. I mentioned that what is really significant and what shows his courage, and this is how we ended, was that in Eastern Europe, he was a Mizrahi rabbi. Okay, so we see the conservative rabbi. Okay, but now you have, I find it hard to believe that the modern Orthodox rabbinate will be able to push this issue. Although doing it in Los Angeles, I think in people's minds they're still going to be wondering, is God the average person doesn't know anything, and I don't know what's pushing it there. It's not a conservative rabbi, so it's hard to say, but it's the OU. Shalchim is the OU Mashkichim. They just won't sell it under OU. So I'll keep you informed if I hear anything else about that. Look, if it's not cheaper, then what's the point anyway? The whole point of it is that if it's supposed to be cheaper, then that's an issue. In Eastern Europe, as we said, the majority of Rabbanim, the well-known Rabbanim, although they weren't all Aguda, they were not Mizrahi, because they thought Mizrahi was problematic. They cooperated with the non-religious Zionists. But you had Rabbanim, especially young Rabbanim, who were Mizrahi. We spoke about Rav Herzog, and Rav Unterman was one of those young rabbis in Eastern Europe and Lithuania who was a proud figure of Mizrahi. As I said, it took a lot of courage to do that. Rabbis lost rabbanus. They lost positions in the rabbinate. And there were many rabbis who were Mizrahi who refused to give up their Mizrahi leanings, or refused to give up their membership in Mizrahi, and because of that they lost positions. And some of these rabbis would be household names today, because they would have been turned into Gedolei Yisrael by the Haredim had they just given up their Mizrahi. I think of Rav Meshulam Roth, author of the Tshuvot Kol Mavasa. I don't know if any of you have heard of him, but he was one of the real important Gedolim in the state of Israel in the early years. And had he agreed to give up Mizrahi, he would have been elected Rav of Chernovitz, he would have been on the Moses Gedolei Torah, he would have been one of, with the Chazon Ish, one of the great ones. But that's not the case. I mentioned how the Rav, in Chamesh Drashot, he writes what gave him the courage and what led him to reject his family tradition and join Mizrahi. This happened after the war. And the Holocaust was of great influence because he showed him that God himself, if you're asking, you know, Joseph was up against his brothers. They were the majority, but he concluded that in this case, God himself paskened on the side of the Mizrahi. Of course, the Aguda could always come back and say, the whole episode of Tanor Shalachnai shows us that we don't look to God to paskin. We have to decide matters ourselves. But the Rav's notion was that we see clearly that the Mizrahi approach is the right way, and that whole essay, the whole shiur that he gave, the drasha, was in order to justify how he was willing to go against his own family tradition, because his grandfather was, together with Lubavitcher Rebbe, the leader of the anti-Zionists, and he was even anti-Aguda. The Rav doesn't mention, but it's worth noting, that his father had already gone halfway. His father taught in Warsaw in the Mizrahi school of the Tachkamoni, and his father was not an Agudist. So the impression that the Rav gives, or that people portraying the Rav, that he just broke with the family tradition, it's not really true. It was his father who broke with the family tradition, although his father never wrote about this, but his father did suffer attacks for this. It was the Rav who really explained what gave him the strength to go public, because the Rav, although he was, apparently the Rav even rebelled against his father, because in the early years when he was in America, he was on the Aguda Presidium. So when he finally breaks with Aguda, he's really joining his father again in what they see as the better approach. At least that's how I see it. Yes, David points out Koma Vassar has a tshuva. He was the first tshuva saying you have to say Hallel with a bracha on Yom HaTzmaut. But if you look at the two volumes, it's to say he's a Gon Shebagonim is putting it mildly. It's, I mean, what can I say? I mean, he's head and shoulders above the other people who are regarded as Gedolim. You see a mind there that's really incredible. And, of course, wide-ranging. He wrote a book on Ibn Ezra, other things, many, many, many important things. And he was in the religious Zionist world. He was, one of the most important figures. But today, certainly outside the land of Israel, his name is not that well known. And I'll tell you that, is, like so many of them, he has grandchildren who are religious Zionists, but he has also grandchildren who are very Haredi. And they reprinted his book on Ibn Ezra, and they got the Dayan from the Eda Haredi to give the Haskama for it. So that's also interesting. It was easy to be a Zionist in America in the 1920s and 30s. Mizrahi ran the show. There were hardly any Agudistan. It was easy to be a Mizrahi in the early years of the state, the 50s, and 60s, and 70s, because all the good positions were given out by Mizrahi. And so even Agudistan had to make believe they were Mizrahi. Unlike today, it's the opposite. But in Europe, if you look at those rabbis who were Mizrahi in Europe, there you see the ones who had courage. Now, in 1924, he goes to Liverpool in England, and he becomes a Rav there, where he was Rav for over 20 years. Sometimes I think that the only good things that ever came out of Liverpool were Rav Unterman and the Beatles. I don't know. Correct me if there's anything else. But he learned English. He became a wonderful English speaker. He was thus able to be a Rav. And he was the postsake and the important authority in Liverpool, a Rav, not just for the East Europeans, because that was his shul, but also for the English speakers. Jerry and the Pacemakers. Okay, I have to confess ignorance. I never heard of them, so what can I tell you? I don't know if that's I'm too young or too old, or just have my head in the book too much. As with other East European rabbis, though, he did have problems. We spoke a bit earlier with Rav Herzog and his father and Rav Deitchus, or Dichus in Hebrew, that the East European rabbis often had problems in England. And here's a typical example of one of the problems. On Herzl's, the anniversary of Herzl's death, Rav Unterman agreed to come speak at one of the big shuls about English shuls, not one of the East European shuls, the United Synagogue shuls. But the rule was the rabbi had to wear canonicals. All the rabbis then wore the canonicals. In fact, there weren't that many rabbis. Most were reverends. And in the fourth volume of his Shevet Mi Yehuda, he has his letter there explaining why he will never, ever wear canonicals. You know, it's that doesn't mean it's halachically wrong. He's not saying that. We spoke about this also, I think, earlier. The Matei Levi has a tshuva. But he says a rav doesn't wear canonicals, certainly not an East European rav. And in the end, they let him go when he gave the drasha, but he didn't wear the canonicals. I was told when I was in England last summer there is no longer even one rav who wears canonicals today. I remember a few semesters back I showed you the picture of Reverend Cohen, the editor of the Sunsino, and he's wearing the dog collar like the Anglican priests. In 1946, that's after 22 years in England as a leading religious Zionist with an international reputation, he is elected chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. Now, in those days, Tel Aviv was not like it is today. Today, we have Jerusalem religion and Tel Aviv hedonism, secularism. Tel Aviv was a much more religious city. First of all, Bnei Brak hardly existed. There was nothing in Bnei Brak, a few blocks. Jerusalem was a very small backwater. Tel Aviv was full of yeshivas, Hasidic rebbes, and had a very strong Orthodox population. And he became rabbi there. It was a very important place. In 1964, 20 years later, he becomes chief rabbi of the State of Israel. Rav Herzog died in 59, 58 or 59, I forget. During that time, there was all sorts of behind-the-scenes politicking. There were two figures. There were really only two figures who could be chief rabbi. And in those days, remember, the Mizrahi, it was very important for the Mizrahi to have someone who was cultured and worldly. They had just come off of Rav Kook, who was could not be replaced. They came off of Herzog, chief rabbi, PhD, speaker of so many languages. You have Rav Unterman, who, although he was never at a university, was a wonderful English speaker and had a secular education, self-taught. And then you had Rav Soloveitchik, holder of a PhD, University of Berlin, the dominant religious Zionist figure in America. These were the only two figures who were seriously considered to be the chief rabbis. No, well, Chief Rabbi Lau, when he lost the chief rabbinate to Metzger, he didn't want to go back to doing nothing, so then he became chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. He had previously been chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. It's often been a stepstone for the chief rabbinate, but he became chief rabbi. If you read his autobiography, which is a wonderful work in Hebrew, he describes how he became chief rabbi. His father-in-law was chief rabbi there before him, and he always had a very good relationship with the non-religious. In Netanya, where he was rabbi before, he was always very good. He's not the Gadol Hador. He's not the greatest Talmud Chacham. He's much greater than the current one, but he's a Talmud Chacham. But what makes him significant is he's a wonderful speaker, and if I challenge anyone to read his autobiography and not get tears in their eyes at some of the things. And I have to confess, I remember when he went to Cuba and he was kissing up to Castro there, I said some terrible things about him, you know. And then when I went to Cuba and I heard from the inside that it was his going to Cuba that enabled all these Jews to come out, and he describes in his autobiography, and he's a very, very impressive person, and I have the greatest respect in the world for him, but partly he is able to speak to the non-religious, and that's why he was made chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. And if you're going to have a crown rabbi, that if you're going to have a rabbi whose job is to represent the Jewish people, Chief Rabbi Lau is the best in the world, no question. Tel Aviv became more of a secular city, with certainly in the last 30, 40 years. The 60s, it still had a strong Orthodox, in the 40s it had an Orthodox component, and ever since then it continues. And it really has picked up in the last 20 years as Jerusalem has become a much more Orthodox city. You had the non-religious emigration there, and Tel Aviv has become an international city. So that's the situation there. Yeah, Rabbi Lau did have a few accusations, but all I can say is that when you read the book, it really overshadows that. That nothing ever was proven with Rabbi Metzger. There actually was a Beis Din of Rav Shaya Yashav Cohen, Rav Simcha Cohen Cook, and Rav Bakshi Doro, and they agreed in the Peshara not to have a court case if he agreed not to run for Chief Rabbi of Tel Aviv. And then there were other issues about him. So it's a totally different situation. And as I said, I have the most respect for Rabbi Lau. The chief rabbinate was empty for 5 years because the question was who was going to fill it. Now everyone knows, or many people know the story of how they tried to get Rav Soloveitchik. There were telegrams, there were others, Reuven Katz, who was the Rebbe of Petach Tikva, led the struggle to bring him in. Many of the religious Zionist intellectuals like Ephraim Orbach and Yaakov Katz, they wanted the Rav, and the Rav thought about it very seriously. I mean, as a religious Zionist, living in Israel is something that you want to do. In the end, he decided not to. He even gave an interview to the Boston Jewish Advocate. He explained that being a rabbi in a situation like in Israel where you're tied to politics and government is involved, that would not give him the freedom he felt he needed, so he turned it down. That's the public reason. People in the know say that there's a much more private reason, and that's his uncle. His uncle, Ravelvel Soloveitchik, who was had passed away by then, but who was him, he loved his uncle, and he gave a great famous eulogy for his uncle. His uncle had put a ban, a cherem, on Hechel Shlomo, on the chief rabbinate. I mean, that was the Haredi Das Torah for so many years, that you could not have anything to do with the chief rabbinate, you couldn't become a dayan for the chief rabbinate. Today, that'll never be quoted. Yatei Neman will never quote the Brisker Rav, because Rav Yashiv has a totally different opinion, and Rav Yashiv himself was a dayan and opposed the Brisker Rav's position and is taking over the Batei Din right now. So they'll never quote what the Brisker Rav said anymore, or even what the Rav Shach or what the Sipor said. But in those days, that was the Das Torah. So how could the Rav go to the land of Israel and break with his family's tradition in the land of Israel? It would have created such a break with the family. He did have relations. He raised money for the Bris Yeshiva. He couldn't even go visit there because how could he go there and not go to Hechel Shlomo? So it was a difficult situation that he was in. Those are the reasons usually given. But where I would differ from the usual portrayal is that everyone assumes that the Rav would have been given it on a platter. And yes, he had the intellectuals, he had certain high-profile rabbis, but there were also many Zionist figures, religious Zionists, also labor Zionists. The people who choose the chief rabbinate, it's not just the religious, it's a majority non-religious. It's full of labor people, people who knew Rav Unterman from Tel Aviv, people who didn't look kindly upon what they considered to be a so-called Zionist, that is someone who stays in, you're going to stay in Boston until you're called to Israel, and then you become a chief rabbi. In other words, you haven't put in your dues. It's like the conflict that broke out under the table, but there's a conflict over Professor Alivni. He just was given the Israel Prize. Many people think it should have gone to Shama Friedman for Talmud. Alivni just came to Israel, and he's given it. And Shama Friedman's been living there for 30 years. So there were many people who thought that Rav Unterman, having served as a rabbi in Tel Aviv for 20 years, having been a religious Zionist in the land of Israel, he should get it. And we're talking also not the intellectuals, we're talking about the masses. So I do not believe necessarily, I certainly have no reason to believe that the Rav would have won this. He lost in the 30s, and I think he probably would have lost again to Rav Unterman, because the Rav is in America, and he has some intellectuals. Rav Unterman had the whole backing in the land of Israel, and he was the leading religious Zionist rabbi. So I assume that maybe the Rav thought he might lose also, and if he didn't lose, it would have been close. In any event, when the Rav decided not to come to the land of Israel, this opened the way, and by the way, this went on, the negotiations. The people who were, certain important people, refused to bring it to a vote until they got the Rav's final word. And this went back and forth between the Rav and them. And finally, when the Rav gave the answer that he wouldn't, it was a rubber stamp. There was no real, there was no opposition, and Rav Unterman became chief rabbi. And by becoming chief rabbi, he became the leader of the world's religious Zionists. Yes, Rabbi Kalman, interject. Okay. We can't hear you, Rabbi. You killed our ears. Sorry. We're getting all that static. So do you want to type
better?
It in? Yeah, that's better. Okay.
Okay. So Rabbi Billet spoke on the relationship of the chief rabbinate and the Orthodox rabbinate. He just mentioned that Ben-Gurion's wife was the one who really wanted the rab because he was a rabbi doctor, went to Ben-Gurion, and Ben-Gurion sent, I forget who, one of the ministers over to meet with the rab and basically to promise him the job on a silver platter. That's what he claimed. Ben-Gurion arranged the whole thing. They sent a shliach, and they were very, they expected he would accept it, and obviously he didn't. Anyway, that's just a different version of events.
That's interesting. Ben-Gurion met the Rav. There's a famous picture of when Ben-Gurion came to YU. He wore that hat of his. So Paula wanted the Rav. What I can say, if that's true, the Rav certainly would have got it, because Ben-Gurion, as the demigod, he could have brought all the laborites into line, and I think that would have certainly given the Rav the election, although without such intervention, I would have assumed that Rav Unterman, who had the really the love and respect of the masses of the religious Zionists, the typical kibbutznik, religious Zionist kibbutznik. What does he know about this Dr. Soloveitchik who lives in Boston? But they knew Rav Unterman. So someone was in the auditorium when Ben-Gurion spoke. They say he never wore a yarmulke, ever. When he was in religious places, he only wore the hat. And Paula, by the way, didn't like religious Jews. Ben-Gurion could tolerate them. He sort of saw them as something on the way out. It's a bit like a museum piece, and he thought it was nice. But Paula, it really got her blood going, religious Jews, religiosity. We'll see in a few classes, next class maybe, Rav Gorin had a very special relationship with Ben-Gurion. So becoming chief rabbi, he becomes the world's most important, I would say, religious Zionist figure. I mean, you think about the Rav. We mentioned this already, but I'll say it again. The Rav was opposed to the way Yom HaTzimut celebrations developed. He was opposed for the prayer for the State of Israel. The fact is that the rabbis in America, North American rabbis, looked towards the chief rabbinate. Even the very students of the Rav did not look towards him. They saw him as out of step on this issue. So the chief rabbi, Rav Herzog of Unterman, were really more important for religious Zionism than Rav Soloveitchik, and much more important. He remains chief rabbi until 1972, and when Rav Gorin comes in, we'll speak about that, and he dies in 1973 at the age of 87. Now, his literary output is found in four big volumes. Here's one of the volumes, Shevet Miyehuda. The last two of the volumes are published by Machon Ariel. That's the Harry Official Institute, and two were published by other publishers. One was published by Moshe Rav Cook. They contained practical halachic rulings, hakiro, Talmudic rulings, all aspects of Jewish thought. Well, it's not just that YU had regular classes. YU, the Rav, did not support, special prayers for Yom HaTzimut. They didn't. In general, everything changes after the Six-Day War, because then you have the heightened religious Zionism and the Messianic type of religious Zionism. But even before that, the Rav was a very different type of religious Zionist. He didn't really see it the same way the others did. We've spoken about this already a good deal. Belkin, to mention it myself, Belkin never went to Israel. He didn't even go there as a tourist. For him, it wasn't such a big deal. It wasn't an important thing. Some of these people were religious Zionists, but in name only. They never had this. The Rav never went to Israel. It's hard to imagine. He wasn't so crazy about his children going. He actually opposed it, and he would have loved for them to come home. Rav Lichtenstein wrote about it somewhere. So he's a different type of religious Zionist. Unfortunately, the people who put together the Shevet Miyehuda were not aware of the essay of Rav Unterman I mentioned last class, the one where he speaks in the Rav Shimon Shkup Jubilee volume, where he gives a beautiful description of Rav Shimon's method of analysis and what these new methods of analysis, why they're so significant. I said that he didn't think that we should mock them or put them down, that this is the way yeshiva bachrim let off steam. This is their recreation. It's quite interesting. They can rejuvenate their creative impulses through that. Now, the first volume, he published it during his lifetime, and then there was an enlarged edition after his death. And three more volumes were published after his death. We can't discuss everything, but I want to pick out a few interesting tshuvot, which are really important in his day. At least one of them was of international importance, or two of them. If I have more time, we'll call attention to some more. First in Shevet Yehuda, Volume 1, which is classical Lithuanian Torah. You see his great learning. Much of it has to do with, a large section has to do with Pikuach Nefesh, saving life. And although it's in the realm of Talmudic Chakira, there's also practical applications. And he raises all sorts of fascinating questions, such as, can you violate Shabbos to come to a beis din and to testify for someone? That is, someone's on trial and he could be sentenced to death. Is that considered Pikuach Nefesh? If you have information, you can come travel? Do you need to put yourself in possible danger to save your friend from certain danger? And that is, you have to jump into the water if it's rough water to save your friend who's drowning. And if so, how do we determine the level of danger? We know that you're obligated to spend money to save someone's life. Are you obligated to lose one of your own limbs? If your neighbor is dying and you can give him a kidney, are you obligated to do that? And if not, why not? Can you give false testimony to save someone's life? He says if two brothers see a murder and the wrong person is being put on trial and they can exonerate him, but only one of the brothers can testify, can the best friend of one of the other brothers who believes this testimony or has, there's no reason he doesn't believe it, can he, or he has information, certain information otherwise, can he lie in the beis din for the greater good, in order to save the human life? I mean, these are all interesting questions. Can you violate Shabbos for mental health? We know the reason for violating Shabbos is that you can observe more Shabbos. Well, can you send someone to a mental institution if he's going to violate Shabbos? Rav Unterman thinks you can. Can you put yourself in a situation where you'll then be obligated to violate Shabbos because it'll be Pikuach Nefesh? I mean, can you willingly give up your life to prevent violation of a sin, that is a sin which you're normally not obligated, like Shabbos. If someone says, violate Shabbos, or I'll kill you, do you have the permission to allow yourself to be martyred? Already the Rambam spoke about this, and he contradicts himself. In the letter on Igeret Hashmad, he says you can, and in the Mishnah Torah, he says you can't. So Unterman discusses this. Now, these are all interesting law school type of questions. They're great for yeshiva bachrim who want to examine various sugyas, but they're not very practical day to day. But in this section, he also has a tshuva dealing with abortion and a complete responsum in the second section. And if this responsum, if anyone knows Rav Moshe Feinstein's responsum on abortion, he quotes Rav Unterman. Rav Unterman and Rav Moshe have the most stringent views on abortion, not permitting it in any circumstances except to save the mother's life. Rav Unterman sees it as akin to actual murder. Rav Moshe does something that no one does. He says it is murder. It's just that we don't punish you. I mean, if it's murder, then why isn't there a punishment for as if you killed someone? Rav Moshe says it's murder, but there's no punishment. This has never before been stated before Rav Moshe. And the clearest proof, that at least according to Rav Moshe, of everyone, that it wasn't murder, is that there's an explicit verse in the Bible which states that a fetus is not a human life. It says that if you knock down a pregnant woman and you hurt her or kill her, it's an eye for an eye, a life for a life. But if you destroy the fetus, all you do is give monetary payment. Ergo showing, according to everyone who's ever written on this, hundreds and hundreds of tshuvas, that a fetus is not a human life, and it's not murder, and this led to all sorts of liberal tshuvot. We discussed the Tzitz Eliezer and others, the Sri Deish, all sorts of interesting tshuvot on abortion. But Rav Moshe and Rav Unterman are very stringent. He also discusses conversion. And let's repeat a little of what we saw with Rav Uziel, because we're going to see a pattern with the rabbis who have responsibility for the state of Israel, Rav Uziel, Rav Unterman, Rav Goren. Between last class and this class, we spoke last class about the RCA. Apparently, the RCA has made an agreement with the chief rabbinate. The chief rabbinate will recognize certain RCA conversions. That's not clear about ones done prior to this, and everyone seems to think the RCA has given in on this. In any event, Rav Unterman, as I said, he was responsible for what's going on in the state of Israel. So I'm not going to say, again, in discussing this, that standards are stricter or more lenient. Rav Unterman, I'm just going to say there are different approaches. Maybe I could say stricter or lenient, but I won't say I don't want to give the impression that one is better than another. And we've already seen Rav Yitzchak Hoffman, and we've seen Rav Uziel. So now let's look at Rav Unterman. In Shevet Miyehuda, Volume 1, he discusses the first great immigration from the Soviet Union to Israel. And that's, I believe it's in the 60s. That's when you had all these non-Jewish spouses. What do you do? It wasn't the 300,000 we have today, but it was a lot. They came with non-Jewish wives, the men, and they also came with non-Jewish children, and the Jewish women came with non-Jewish men. He says, just like I was mentioning before, that the religious Zionist approach is, we must find a way to convert these people, or otherwise we're going to have mass assimilation, intermarriage in the state of Israel. The question is, same question we've seen already, how can you convert people when they're not going to observe Torah and Mitzvot? Don't we know that unless you agree to observe Torah and Mitzvot, you can't be converted? And these people coming from Russia are obviously not of the type that they're going to become immediately good religious Jews. And yet, we ask them, do you accept Torah and Mitzvot? Even if they tell us they do, how can we believe them? Look at the picture here. Someone comes over, a Jewish man with a non-Jewish woman. The man is not at all religious, so we're going to convert the woman. We're going to ask the woman, are you going to observe Torah and Mitzvot? She's living with someone who's not observant. So what kind of situation is that? Clearly it won't be a religious home. Similarly, can you convert the children? How can you convert the children if they're going to be brought up in a non-religious home? Now, Rav Unterman begins the tshuva by noting that in the Galut, in the diaspora, there were rabbis, many rabbis, who refused to accept these sorts of converts, people converted for marriage. Why? Because they were not intent on following Torah and Mitzvot, and we do not want converts. How does it benefit us to have converts who don't follow Torah and Mitzvot? We saw Rahuziel's answer that in some cases, when it's an intermarriage situation, it's the least evil of the possible situations. It's the least bad. But Rav Unterman says that when he was rabbi in England, he never converted people for the sake of marriage. And Rav Uziel's position that this is better than intermarrying, that did not move Rav Unterman. He was stringent. He said that this is the halacha, they're not going to be valid, good converts, we don't convert them. However, and by the way, intermarriage, he says, was a big problem in England. And it still didn't move him. Because he said that, first of all, if anyone knows that they can convert their non-Jewish spouse, well, there's no problem with them, just like the Syrians say. They'll just date non-Jews, and then they'll marry the non-Jew, and then they'll convert the non-Jew, and it won't be really a religious home. And Rav Unterman points out something else. He says that all these people who wanted to convert, they were still living in the same neighborhood, they had the same friends. What type of conversion is that? A conversion means a new life. I mean, someone who's non-Jewish and has a real conversion, they can't live among the same people. They're a new person. They have a new way of life. So he never would do it. However, what about in Israel? Israel's a very different circumstance. First of all, they've already come. They've left the Soviet Union. They've come to Israel. It's a new environment. We can't say that they're going to be around the old friends. Number two, we have to be very concerned with the future, their children, the break among the Jewish people in the state of Israel. If you have a Klal Yisrael, Eretz Yisrael conception, making sure that Israel remains a Jewish state, that's very important. And that's going to push you in a direction of leniencies that were not relevant in the diaspora. What does it matter in a diaspora? But in Israel, all these people are part of the collective. And what about the idea that they're not going to be observant of Torah and Mitzvot? Rav Unterman, similarly to what Rav Uziel says, that unless we see that it's a fraudulent conversion, what does he mean by a fraudulent conversion? If someone, for example, is living in a secular kibbutz, where the food is all non-kosher, that's a situation where they can't be observing Torah and Mitzvot. But if someone is living in a house in Tel Aviv, and they tell us that they accept Torah and Mitzvot, the fact that we might think otherwise, that's not a reason to invalidate a conversion. And once they convert, even if next week you see that they are not living a Jewish life, he says that nowhere do you find that you can invalidate a conversion ex post facto. I know today people are saying you can. I have a picture. Maybe I'll show you next class. There was Rav Unterman with Rav Yashiv, because he was on his Beis Din, and apparently Rav Yashiv disagrees. Rav Unterman says once someone is accepted, and the Beis Din accepts them. If they were not, the Beis Din does not have to accept them, but once they're accepted ex post facto, a conversion can never be invalidated unless you know at the time, and there's no way to know this, but unless, in theory, unless you knew at the time that it was just a joke for the person. But if the person accepts it and then you see them the next week living a non-observant life, you have to make the assumption that at the time they wanted to be religious and now they don't want to. So you might laugh at this and say, well, that's naive. But that's how halacha works in many areas. We rely on all sorts of things that maybe don't stand up to logical scrutiny. But this is, like, take, we discussed over Shabbos, me and some others, Bishul. Isn't it a klal that there's no bishul and a klisheni or a klishlishi? I mean, that's not bishul like cooking, because if it's hot enough, then it cooks. This is halachic bishul. Halacha has its own understanding. So the halacha says that, just like we spoke with Rav Uziel and DNA. So you could say, I could look at the DNA and I could see if the kid's a mamzer. Rav Uziel's point is, he was speaking about blood tests. That's not halachic knowledge. We don't look at blood tests. Rav Unterman says, after the fact, it has no relevance. We only look at what the person says. If the person at this moment is living in a non-religious kibbutz, that's a block. But if there's nothing staring us in the face, then we believe the person, and if the person afterwards isn't following through, then that person is a sinning Jew and has to do tshuva like all other Jews. And by the way, that's Rav Moshe's position, apparently, because Rav Moshe says that... although he doesn't like to do these marriages, these conversions, he understands those rabbis who do them. And this is really Rav Uziel and Dorothy Hoffman's position. And Rav Unterman says that there are many cases that he had where people converted, and they did become religious, either a little more religious or a lot more religious. So we don't make deals. We don't make assumptions. And, the obvious thing would be to say, well, then let's watch them afterwards. Let's watch if we see them in a year. And all, then we would know some conversions would be successful and others would not be. But Rav Unterman says he can't do that because there's no such thing as voiding the conversion. We just have to do the conversion to the best of our ability and hope that they'll, and it doesn't have to be tzaddikim gemurim, maybe the children will get Jewish education, the home will be more of a Jewish home than it was before. And according to Rav Unterman, that's enough. We've already seen now Rav Dovitzi Hoffman, Rav Uziel, now we see Rav Unterman, we'll see Rav Gorin, that one doesn't need to observe all of the Torah. Simply accepting it is enough. Okay, and he makes it clear that it's the current situation which is forcing him in this direction. He also quotes the David from Beit Shemesh mentioned Rav Chaim Ozer. He quotes Rav Chaim Ozer. Rav Chaim Ozer makes a distinction between Chachila, that is ab initio rejection, that is someone who doesn't, because the Gemara says if you reject any part of Torah, it's not a valid conversion, even a rabbinic law. It's the difference between one who says the rabbis don't have authority, or the Torah doesn't have authority, I reject on principle the Torah's law, in which case you're a heretic, and you can't be converted, the Beis Din cannot convert you, and someone who says, yes, I know this is the law, we're not allowed, you have to keep kosher, but, and the person's honest, I'm not going to keep it. I'm telling you, Rabbi, yes, I know it's the law. I'm going to try. It's the best thing. But speaking realistically, when I go on my business trips, there's no kosher food, I'm going to go to McDonald's. Rav Chaim Ozer says that that's considered latei avon. You know, you accept the idea of Torah, but you acknowledge that you're not going to live up to it. Rav Chaim Ozer says that that's okay. Not everyone accepts Rav Chaim Ozer. The Gevar Avraham, Rav Avram Shapiro of Kovno rejects Rav Chaim Ozer, but that's Rav Chaim Ozer's. You can't get bigger than Rav Chaim Ozer. And Rav Unterman quotes Rav Chaim Ozer in support of his own position that you can accept converts who will not be ideologically a sinner, ideological sinners, but simply be sinners, like everyone's a sinner. I mean, the problem that Rav Unterman is faced with, if you're going to say that sins void a conversion, well, then what's sin? Well, Shabbos, maybe Shabbos is a big one. What about Kashrus? I mean, Kashrus, we think it's very big. But at the end of the day, it's only a lav. It's not a, there's no kares. It's not a misa. We say they even have to accept the rabbinic prohibition. So let's say the person speaks Lashon Hara. Or let's say the person, I mean, where do you draw the line? Rav Unterman says you don't draw the line. If there's nothing staring you in the face, you accept the conversion, just like Rav Dovitzi Hoffman and Rav Uziel. I think the Haredi say, no, we don't want more Jews, and it's quality, not quantity. The difference is, and Rav Uziel says we don't want more Jews. Rav Uziel's position, although there are opinions, the Zohar Rakia, the Tashbetz, for example, says it's a mitzvah to convert people. Rav Uziel says we only want Jews when they're going to be good Jews, observe Torah and mitzvos. However, when it's a choice of allowing losing a Jew, that is, if someone is intermarried, then it's not a choice of wanting more Jews. We're preventing this Jew from being lost. In such a case, we'll convert people, even though it's not the best conversion. I mean, I don't understand, Mati, why do we want Jews who will not observe Torah and mitzvos? And what's the point of having, we have enough Jews who don't observe? What do we get? Now you say we might get more numbers to give to the United Jewish Appeal and all that. But at the end of the day, this creates all sorts of problems for us. So conversion is supposed to be about joining the Jewish people and following the Torah. And the Haredim take this very seriously, and they don't have the same Klal Yisrael conception. However, in recent years, there's been a big change in the Haredi world because now they have been pushing conversions. They're still much more strict than the religious Zionist rabbis in that they really require a high level of Torah and mitzvot. However, until about 4 years ago, or 3 years ago, the notion that the Haredim would want to encourage people in an intermarriage, the non-Jewish partner, to convert was considered blasphemy. They thought that was the worst thing in the world. Now they're actually doing this. And they got the certain Gedolim to agree, and the Badats in Israel, Rav Sternbach and others, have said this is terrible. And, I mean, the Haredim can totally change their tune, and no one seems to notice. They act as if this is the way they've always been doing things. This is a very new thing they're doing right now, and it's... Kashrus has always been big because it seems to them, okay, but, I mean, at the end of the day, Kashrus is not one of the big ones. I don't know where you... Kashrus has all sorts of sociological significance also. But if you look in the history of American Orthodoxy, for example, eating out, eating fish out, all this, that never meant that someone wasn't part of the Orthodox community. So in reality, it has never had that much of an importance in how people define themselves as Orthodox. So you have three big ones. But still, I mean, where are you going to draw the line? If the Gemara says you have to accept everything. So if someone speaks Lashon Hara, you know, for Rav Unterman, this is all before the fact. If someone says before the fact, I don't believe that there's an idea of Lashon Hara. Let's say he works for the Star magazine and is going to publish Lashon Hara on a daily basis. Or if even a tiny thing, someone says, I don't accept kidneyos. If it's an ideological thing, that was probably enough to avoid it. So that's Rav Unterman. Rav Unterman follows through Rav Uziel's position, and you hear people talk about the phony conversions of the chief rabbinate. They're not phony conversions. It's a shita. It's a shita that basically we can convert people even though they're not going to be shomer Torah or mitzvos. For Rav Uziel, that's totally fine. For Rav Unterman, it's not really fine, but we don't have a choice because we don't know. As long as they come to us and they tell us they're going to be, and also they might be a little bit observant, you know. So and we'll see what Rav Gorin says. Rav Gorin gives the most wide ranging justification of this. We'll see this either next class or the class after. But note, he's talking about Eretz Yisrael, and Rav Gorin is very clear. He had the radical step that his conversion is only valid in Israel, as we'll see, which is a completely new idea. This is everything we're saying now is not referring to the Golus. And as I said, Rav Unterman was opposed to this in the Golus. Rav Uziel was not. Rav Uziel thought that this was a valid procedure, apparently, even in the Golus. But be that as it may, there's different views among the Gedolim. Okay, I want to move on then to another tshuva, which I'll start it now. And this is very important. This is written up in the Jewish Week of a couple of months ago because Roy Riskin wrote in something which people thought was maybe disrespectful both to Rav Unterman and the Rav. Rav Unterman's notion of saving non-Jews on Shabbos, which became very famous. Let me first give you the background. We all know that there's a halacha that we violate Shabbos to save non-Jews on Shabbos. The question is why? And the reason given by the Talmud is that if we don't violate Shabbos for them, they won't violate Shabbos for us. So it appears to be utilitarian ethics. And apparently in a situation where you wouldn't need to, and there are authorities who say that, you don't. The Meiri, incidentally, says that this is a law directed against the wicked pagans of old. It doesn't apply to contemporary Gentiles. Now, this has been in the news fairly recently because Noah Feldman, I'm sure you all know Noah Feldman's article, he mentions this in his piece, that this is one of the things he was told in the Maimonides Yeshiva. Now, the Rav famously replied, when he was asked by Gerald Blitzstein in the 60s, there was this, the controversy that broke out in Israel, which I'll describe in a minute, over saving non-Jews on Shabbos, where Soloveitchik says he doesn't understand what the whole controversy is. Because, of course, we always save non-Jews on Shabbos, and Blitzstein, Gerald Blitzstein, asked the Rav, and I quoted this in my book, and since then, it's been, Blitzstein wrote about it in an article in New Orthodox Forum. Blitzstein asked the Rav, and you should know for a second who Blitzstein is. He could ask the Rav these sorts of questions. Gerald Blitzstein, according to Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Gerald Blitzstein is the best student the Rav ever had. Now, some people might say, well, the Rav Lichtenstein is, and perhaps he is, but Rav Lichtenstein is not going to say that about himself. So in any event, maybe Gerald Blitzstein is the second greatest student the Rav ever had. Gerald Blitzstein is now professor of Judaics of Jewish thought at Ben Gurion University. He's the winner of the Israel Prize. A Musmach of YU, a Talmud of the Rav. He is the grandson of Rav Moshe Ben Yamin Tomashov, who was a big Rav in Brooklyn, one of the Gedolim of America. So he had a connection to the Rav through his grandfather. He was able to ask him things that other people couldn't. And he asked the Rav straight out in front of everyone, does this reason satisfy you morally? And the Rav replied, no. What's the issue that came up? Well, there was a man who lived in Israel named Israel Shahak, and he was a leading anti-Orthodox person. When I say anti-Orthodox, I mean so he must have grown up Orthodox, because people don't become that Orthodox unless they grew up and rejected it. And I'm not talking about a Tommy Lapid here, or a Sheen. I don't believe for a minute that Tommy Lapid is anti-Orthodox. He's anti-Haredi. That's very different than being anti-Orthodox. I mean, he has you can have a lot of respect for the people who serve in Hezder, etc., but you don't want religious laws that affect. You know, he wants a place like America where the Orthodox do their thing and they don't try to put in discriminatory laws against the non-Orthodox, tell them they can't drive on Shabbos, etc., etc. And he was always anti-Haredi because he thought that they were taking all this money and they weren't giving anything back. But the Israel Shahak, who died about 10 years ago, wrote a book in English too, he was anti-Orthodox. And he claimed, and this was a big, this became front page news in all the Israeli newspapers, because he claimed that he was a Measharim, and he witnessed a non-Jew fall down, having a heart attack or something, or sort of what went on American Airlines 2 days ago, and no one did anything, and they allowed the person to die. Because you can't violate Shabbos for a non-Jew. Now, it turned out later, and he had to admit this was a complete falsification. It never happened. It's sort of like Noah Feldman's falsification. He knew that the picture was not cropped, although not that there would be anything wrong with it, to adopt a Seinfeld line. If I was running it, I would have cropped the picture of him out. But it turns out he knew, and he was my classmate, and I know him, but it turns out that he knew, and the New York Times knew, that what he was writing was false. So the New York Times has a history of writing false things. I presume this McCain stuff is also false. Israel Shahak knew that this was false, and he said it, and his justification for saying it, well, the issue was real. Even if the case never happened, even if he never witnessed this person fall down and die, it could have happened, because all Orthodox Jews believe that you don't save non-Jews on Shabbos. So he felt it was okay for him to libel, and just like Noah Feldman felt it was okay for him to libel, not just libel, to create a situation where medical doctors, Jewish medical doctors, might be put in all sorts of precarious situations, and almost like a blood libel, Israel Shahak and Noah Feldman. And I'll tell you, by the way, with the Noah Feldman, just so you know, this isn't something new. He was he comes from an Orthodox background. I wrote a bit about him on the Sfarim blog. You can see it. He was the pro bono lawyer for the town of Tenafly fighting the Erev. You see that obviously he has issues here. It's one thing not to be Orthodox, but to, I mean, to fight the Erev, I mean, okay. And that's the case. And this is what Rav Unterman had to respond to. And he comes up with a brilliant chiddush, and we'll get into that next class. We still have about 15 more minutes. I want to do Rav Unterman on that, and also a very daring tshuva of Rav Unterman on divorce, and then we'll be able to move on to Rav Gurin. But it was this idea of Rav Unterman that he became very fond of, that he repeated when he came to YU, and the Rav wasn't so enamored by it. And that's what Rabbi Riskin quoted the Rav, that when Rav Unterman left, the Rav says that he doesn't buy it. And people were very upset with Rav Riskin, because first of all, they said it doesn't make Rav Unterman look good, and one of Rav Unterman's grandchildren wrote into the Jewish Week, if you recall. And people thought it doesn't make the Rav look very good, because the Rav didn't publicize this. He told this privately to some students. And here Rabbi Riskin is, you know, here Rav Unterman was on the forefront of fighting for Torah, up against forces you wouldn't believe, the anti-religious forces. And he certainly did not want to undercut Rav Unterman in any way. Christopher Hitchens is his Talmud Muvhak. No, well, Christopher Hitchens is not Jewish. So, and we can't compare the two. And Christopher Hitchens is not anti-Orthodox. Christopher Hitchens is anti-God. He's anti-religion. There's a big difference. And, yes, he takes on the Orthodox, but he also takes on the Muslims and he takes on the Christians. So, it's very in today to be anti-God. And, Christopher Hitchens is one of those. And all I can say is if the best that we can put up against Christopher Hitchens is Shmuley Boteach. You can watch him on YouTube. Not to take away anything from Shmuley Boteach, but at the end of the day, we have many people who are a lot better qualified than Shmuley Boteach to argue with Christopher Hitchens, who in addition to being a very smart person, is a great debater. And I can think of a David Schatz or people like that are certainly much more qualified to take on Christopher Hitchens. In any event, Christopher, his opposition to religion is because he and others take caricatures. You can always take a caricature. I can describe what goes on with the Taliban or what goes on in Mea Shearim, and I can caricature it, and certainly it's going to look foolish to everyone. But there was a piece in the New Republic about 3 months ago that how so much of this is simplistic, and that an atheist wrote it, and how he's embarrassed to see this because there used to be sophisticated atheists. There used to be Bertrand Russell. There used to be all sorts of sophisticated atheists. And now you have pop atheists. And the worst is the Jew, Sam Harris, who's a complete ignoramus. Ah, he mentioned him completely. Okay, so there you see. Noah Feldman is becoming, we say in the Talmudic expressions, an Elon. He's becoming a tree to hang your hat on. And Noah Feldman is one of the great public intellectuals now. He's a professor of law at Harvard. I will say, though, that he will never be Supreme Court Justice because the dishonesty he showed in that piece, if he ever, when his time comes, the Jewish community will not forget that. And it was a hatchet job. And at the end of the day, here's a guy, professor at Harvard, Justice Souter's assistant, and he's bothered that the newsletter of his high school doesn't mention his marriage. I mean, obviously there's real issues here. Let's put things in perspective. Okay, Rabbi Kelman, you're sorry. Organized debate with
lots of other things first on my agenda.
I will tell you, by the way, that the OU, I don't know how they got away with this. I mean, the OU, on one hand, does things so far to the right, which is crazy. On the other hand, in Los Angeles, they organize a debate between Rabbi Adlerstein and Dennis Prager. I like debates and everything, but here you have the OU organizing a debate where someone is going to be preaching heresy. It's like the Reinman-Hirsch book. Prager is a smart guy and a great debater. I assume that many people listening to this debate, either online or in person, are going to come away thinking that Prager got the better of the debate. So I'm not saying it's a bad thing to do. I just don't know how the OU's post scheme ever permitted such a thing like that. And having listened to the debate, I tell you that Prager did get some good jabs in, and Adlerstein, although he did the worthy defense, there's no question that Prager had some landed some shots. Okay, you have any other questions? If not, okay, well, then we will pick up next week. Okay, one more question from Yisrael. Now, well, as I said, we'll have about 15 more minutes.
If people
are
asking me to do this, I'll just point in. Yeah, if somebody wants to come up. Okay,
by the way, he's very expensive. I'm sure it's 15 grand minimum.
If somebody wants to give us the $25,000, and it might be more, then we can begin the conversation.
Okay. You asked some other Mizrahi Gedolim who would have been Haredi Gedolim if not for Mizrahi. Well, I don't need to go to the past. I can speak today. If Rav Aaron Lichtenstein and Rav Nachum Rabinovich were Agudistin, they would be on the Moetzes Gedolia Torah. If Rav Schechter was an Agudistin, they would say that he's the Gadol Ador or something. I mean, look who's on the Moetzes Gedolia Torah today. No one measures up to him. It's the Rosh Yeshiva YU. It's always been this way. Now, we hear about these people because, as I said at the beginning, we are enmeshed in the Haredi world. They're teachers, they're rabbis. I mean, they speak at all our shuls, although, as I said, it doesn't go the reverse. You never have modern Orthodox rabbis speaking at the Haredi shuls. So all these people, Rabbi Weinberg, you have to look in Rabbi Weinberg's letters that I published in Torah Ma'ad Journal. He saw this in the 1960s. He says that any small Rosh Yeshiva, anyone that the Aguda picks to be Anyone who joins the Aguda turns him into a Gadol Yisroel. He says, with the Aguda, Gadolim sprout up like grass. Because it's all political with them. And you see this with Rav Elyashiv. He was not a Gadol until he left the Rabbanut. If Rav Goren never became chief rabbi, which we'll discuss next class, Rav Elyashiv would be a Dayan among the chief rabbinate, and he would be regarded as a nobody by the Haredim. He'd be the same Lamdan. He'd be the same great Torah scholar. But it's because he's not in their political camp, they won't give him the respect. So, all the great chief rabbis were Gadol Yisrael, the Dayanim were Gadol Yisrael, there's many, many names, but, and in the religious Zionist world, you know about these people, but it's politics. I realize that, and I understand the Kashrus division, that you need to have Rebelsky. Some people might find it strange, or this chayrim they just put out against the Jewish concerts, where Rebelsky signs it, so does that mean the OU doesn't believe in Jewish concerts? But they needed to get the Haredim to trust the OU. So I understand it's important. Many of the Mashkichim are Haredim. They need to get a well-respected figure in the Haredi world so that the OU would be accepted by everyone. That's the reason also they can't do non-glot. They can't even do glot and non-glot, because that would raise questions in people's minds. So I understand the OU, but the OU Kashrus used to be tied much more closely to the OU, and the money from OU Kashrus is what supports everything. So, of course, no, I understand. It's a totally different division, though. They used to be gaining. You have to look at the era. In Europe, it was all ideology. They thought Mizrahi was correct. In the early years of the state, you have many Aguda-type rabbis who realize that the only way you can get appointed to be a Dayan or appointed to be a rabbi of a city is to join the Mizrahi or to be like a Mizrahiist, and therefore they join Mizrahi. It depends on today. You're not getting any advantages in Israel as a religious Zionist. On the contrary, it's very hard for religious Zionist Dayanim to be appointed. So I think we're back to what it was in Europe in the early part of the century. It's true believers. Look, if you believe something, you're not going to sell your soul. I wouldn't expect the Haredim to sell their soul either. If you're a religious Zionist, you're going to stand up for what you believe in, and you're going to suffer. Professor Twersky said it after the Rav passed away. It wasn't the secular studies. Had Rav Soloveitchik not been a Zionist, the Aguda would have made him the Pope of the world, the undisputed Gadol Yisrael. They love it when the Gadolim have secular studies, because then they can say, oh, you see how bad, he could tell you how bad it is, and how you shouldn't go to college. So it's, the Rav gave up a lot, and others gave up a lot. He had breaks with his own family over this, so. But if you believe something is right, you have to be guided by your ideology. Isn't that what Torah is all about? Rav Zevin and Rav Kasher were both Mizrahiists, and both suffered as well. Rav Zevin was, he was a Chabadnik, but we shall have a class on Rav Zevin, hopefully. He was a Babroisker, he wasn't a Lubavitcher. There was a time when you have Chabadniks who were not Lubavitch, so he wasn't bound to the Rebbe. And Rav Kasher was a Gera Chassid, but he broke with them. Because he became a real Zionist. And therefore, in the yeshiva world, he was no longer called Rav Menachem Kasher. He was called Rav Menachem Treif. So, these are all figures that hopefully we'll have time. They were figures. Oscar tried to Kasher him. I tried to Kasher Rav Zevin.
They tried to Kasher Rav Zevin by playing around with what he wrote, of course.
They censored him. Rav Zevin's one of the great ones. We'll get to him. And Rav Kasher also, today, though, it's very different. There was a time, they said, this goes back to the era of the 50s and 60s and 70s when you had great authorities. Today, you don't have as many. But still, there are some, and you shouldn't lose hope. Everyone has, every star has a day. one more question. They did band together, but what you've had in the last... you've had enormous Haredi growth in the last 20 years in Israel, and that's given them enormous power, especially the Shas party, which is a Haredi party, but the people who vote for it are not Haredi. You've had incredible growth, though, in Haredi yeshivas, all due to the fact that the Israeli government is funding them and giving them the draft exemption and everything. This never could have happened on its own. The average Haredi person, you could never have a Haredi community, because if people go to work and if people go to university and are out there in the world, they're not going to be so extreme, because they're out there in the world. They're with non-religious people. They're more moderate. These people, though, are never out there in the world. They're living in a ghetto, be it B'nai Brak or elsewhere. As soon as the draft exemption is finished, as soon as they can go to work, all this would change, because then they would no longer be dominated by the Rosh Yeshiva. But you do have incredible numbers now, and politically they're able to take over. What can I tell you? The Mizrahi liked it when they controlled the rabbinates. Now the rabbinates and the Dayanim are being controlled by the Haredim, and they don't like it anymore. I think the answer is, as Rosh Yeshiv Cohen and Rabakshi Daron pointed out, it was a bad idea to begin with. But I didn't see the portrayal of Rav Unterman. I have both of the volumes. This is Rav Shlomo Lawrence's book, and I even am reading what he writes about the Chazon Ish now, but I don't know, I haven't gotten up to anything where he speaks about Rav Unterman. Even without reading it, I can tell you that every Gadol is referred to Hagon, and when it came to Rav Unterman, I'll just call him Rav Unterman. He won't get the title Hagon. But, okay, if you just email me the page number, at least, and I will, he's unnamed. Well, there's many, they often refer, I think you're referring to Rav Unterman. They talk about a Rav of a big city who used to come to the Chazon Ish. I think the story you're talking about is the Chazon Ish. They asked him, why do you show such kavod to him? And he says, because if I show kavod to him, then I'll be able to influence him. Implication, I don't have kavod for him at all. Look, all I can say is, I don't believe these stories. I have no reason to believe any of these stories. Yes, the Chazon Ish had a different position, but why, this is a source coming from a Haredi source, an anti-Rav Unterman source. Or you could say that the Chazon Ish said this to Lawrence, so that Lawrence wouldn't think that he's a Zionist or something like that. In other words, I don't see how these stories, for every story like that, you could have other stories of where the Chazon Ish said the exact opposite. So if the Chazon Ish is telling one person, I'm just doing it for show, and then someone else says, no, he's doing it the other way for show, I don't know where you get. I think you have to judge public statements, and if the Chazon Ish threw Rav Unterman out, then that says something. But he treats him like a gadol, and he gives him kavod, and he corresponds with all these things, and you say he's only doing it because, it's hard to say. I don't go for all this stuff. But there's no question, as we saw, Chazon Ish was not a religious Zionist. Rav Unterman was. But all the evidence we spoke about is Chazon Ish could have respect for people whom he disagreed. So I can imagine him saying to Lawrence, why do I give him such great respect? Because, I want to be able to maybe give him some input. If I didn't give him any respect, if I didn't relate to him, then, we'd be totally cut off. But at the end of the day, who knows? There's contradictory stories in all these books. In any event, we'll pick up with this next week and finish with Rav Unterman on to Rav Gorin. And good night, everyone.